So this is Bio 241, and it is November 11th, and we're in the middle of the endocrine system, and I still intend to have the test a week from this Thursday, which is going to be what? I don't know what date that is. Is that the 20th? The 20th? Yeah, the 20th. So not this Thursday, but a week from this Thursday. And the drop date, and kind of pushing it for that test, but the drop date is the 22nd. So I don't know if anybody's in the category in here trying to figure out if you're going to stay in the class or not, but that will give you plenty of time to figure out what you want to do with that. So, all right, so let's finish up with the endocrine system today. And does anybody have any questions? Any questions? Let's just review real quick. What the heck is a hormone? What is a hormone? It's a chemical. What's it secreted by? It travels through the blood. I agree with that. But what kind of what secretes it? A gland, right? But what kind of gland? A ductless gland. What do we call a ductless gland? An endocrine gland. A gland that does not have a duct. What do we call a gland that does have a duct? Exocrine. Give me an example of an exocrine gland. Sweat glands. Salivary glands. Yeah. Okay. Very good. So a hormone is something that's secreted by an endocrine gland that gets picked up by a capillary. It's absorbed into the circulatory system, distributed throughout the whole body. It goes to a target tissue where it elicits some kind of specific response in that target tissue. It's going to change the metabolism in that cell, maybe by activating certain enzymes or deactivating enzymes inside that cell. So how does a target tissue know that it is a target tissue? How does it know to listen for a particular hormone? Maybe you said when I was talking, so I didn't quite hear. Yeah, the target tissue has to have a receptor. And how do you explain the binding of a hormone to a receptor? To somebody. Yes, it's very specific.
Oh, a lock and key.
But a good model, I should have said model, a good model you should have in your mind is lock and key. The shape of the hormone has to be complementary to the shape of the receptor so that they can fit together. So it's by shape. That's a lock and key, right? Because the key has got to have the right shape before it will fit in the lock and turn the tumbler. It's got to have the right shape. So it is by shape. And then when it binds to a receptor, it's going to produce some kind of response inside the cell. So for instance, there are two main kinds of receptors by location in the cell. Where do you find receptors in the cell? Outside the cell on the plasma membrane or inside. So we call those extracellular or cytoplasmic receptors. What kind of hormone binds to a cytoplasmic or a nuclear receptor, something inside the cell? Automatically, you should know that a good example would be steroids, but more generally speaking, any kind of lipid hormone can move across the plasma membrane and can enter the cell and then bind to receptors that are cytoplasmic or nuclear. Any kind of lipid hormone. All right, but hydrophilic hormones have to bind where? To receptors that are outside the cell on the cell membrane. So what's a good example of a hydrophobic kind of receptor? I have it on the board. It's going to be a G protein coupled receptor. Okay? And so this is a G protein coupled receptor, and you can see the hormone binding to it extracellularly. So this is the first messenger, and this is always going to produce some kind of second messenger inside the cell. And in this particular case, phospholipase C is activated. What's the substrate for phospholipase C? Phospholipase, well, I tell you what, what is phospholipase C? What kind of compound is it? It's an enzyme, right? Because there's an ASC on the end of it. So what is the substrate for phospholipase C? I give you a hint. Don't say C. No, not acetyl something, not amino something. Just look at the first part of the word of the enzyme. Phospholipid. So is it difficult for phospholipase C to find a phospholipid anywhere? To convert into something? Oh, because it's right in the membrane. That's the basic building block of the plasma membrane. It's a phospholipid. Okay, so phospholipase C converts phospholipids, which are just parts of the plasma membrane, and it converts it into IPI3, which is inositol 3-phosphate. Then IPI3 is the second messenger that goes inside the cell that opens up calcium channels on sarcoplasmic reticulum. Well, if that was in muscle, or smooth endoplasmic reticulum, if it's any other kind of cell. And then the calcium is a signal that might change metabolism inside the cell. What have you learned about calcium? What kind of molecule can calcium bind to within a cell that can activate or inactivate various enzymes? Calmodulin is what I was thinking of. Calmodulin is a regulatory protein. Once it binds calcium, it can activate maybe kinase enzymes or phosphodiesterases or something that will manipulate the phosphate metabolism inside the cell. Okay. So that's just a little bit of a review. Here is how epinephrine can affect blood glucose levels by two kinds of receptor systems. Beta-adrenergic affect the adenylate cyclase by G-protein coupled receptors, right, by increasing cyclic AMP, but it can also affect alpha-adrenergic effectors on liver cells, increasing calcium levels in the cell, which then bind to calmodulin, which then activate protein kinases, which then activate, what is this pathway? Glycogen to glucose. What's that pathway? Glycogenolysis, right? Sure, just by phosphorylating an enzyme in this pathway, it turns it on. Dephosphorylating turns it off. And when it's turned on, that puts glucose into the blood, raising blood glucose levels. Okay. All right, then we talked about the tyrosine kinase receptor system. What is that used for? Tyrosine kinase. Is it intracellular or extracellular receptor? Tyrosine kinase. Let's see if I can do this. It would be nice to sit down. I can't reach my mouse very well, though. It is extracellular. Sure, look. Here is the extracellular side. Here's the membrane. Here's the intracellular side. And what binds to the tyrosine kinase receptor? Insulin. Okay, so what does insulin do? Increase blood glucose or decrease blood glucose? It decreases blood glucose. Okay, so the mechanism that does that is that once insulin binds to tyrosine kinase, then, so this is a receptor enzyme becomes activated, and the receptor enzyme then phosphorylates tyrosine amino acids that are in numerous proteins, regulatory proteins inside the cell, which then cause the fusion of these endosomes into the cell membrane. And in these endosomes are little transporters. For what? For glucose. Right? Because glucose can't enter the cell by itself because it is a hydrophilic molecule. It needs a GLUT4 transporter for facilitated diffusion. And when they're inserted into the membrane, the cell can take up glucose. Glucose going from high concentration to low. And when glucose enters the cell, it decreases the concentration in the blood. And then the other nice thing is that the cell doesn't starve to death either. So that's good. All right, so we're at the... Who? The glucose is hydrophilic. So a hydrophilic molecule can't move across the plasma membrane by itself. So unfortunately, or fortunately, glucose is restricted from entering a cell. Only in the presence of insulin, which acts as a passport to allow glucose to enter, because insulin inserts these GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane. So glucose can diffuse into the cell. Glucose cannot diffuse without the GLUT4 transporter. Now, I did say something else that's incredibly powerful information to know, and that is, what else inserts these GLUT4 transporters into the plasma membrane of muscle cells? Besides the insulin signal, there's something else. So if you're a diabetic and your glucose is sky high, what would you like to do? Would you like to lower that blood glucose? Absolutely. Okay, diabetes type 1, you can give insulin. All right, but what is another way? Exercise. You exercise those muscles, and just by exercising muscles, that fuses these endosomes to the plasma membrane, and the muscle cells can take up glucose. Right, so that counteracts the effects of that diabetes condition. So insulin and exercise certainly can help somebody with diabetes, at least type 1. Okay, pituitary gland. Remember that it is made up of two parts, the anterior and posterior. The posterior part is nervous tissue. It's from the brain, and the anterior part is glandular in nature. And there are different ways that the pituitary communicates with the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus controls the pituitary gland in two different ways, depending if there are hormones from the anterior or the posterior pituitary. On this slide here, we see how the anterior pituitary is being controlled. There are blood vessels that take hormones from the hypothalamus and carry them directly to the anterior pituitary gland. And these hormones are called releasing factors or releasing hormones. So there are neurons in the hypothalamus. When an axon reaches its axon terminus right here, that causes the fusion of synaptic vesicles and release of, typically we consider it a neurotransmitter, but that signaling compound isn't stimulating another nerve cell directly, it's picked up by the circulatory system. So these compounds, since they're released from neurons, we like to call these neurotransmitters. But since they're picked up by the blood, we like to call them hormones. So if someone asks you, well, are these releasing factors hormones or neurotransmitters? The best answer to say is what? Is that they're actually acting as both. So they're neurohormones in this particular case. Releasing hormones, releasing factors are neurohormones. And then they will elicit the secretion of other hormones from the anterior pituitary. This right here, so we see two capillary beds back to back. What does a normal circulation have? Like the systemic circulation or the pulmonary circulation. As an artery leaves the heart and then it goes through something and then into a vein back to the heart, how many capillary beds does it normally go through? You know what? It just goes through one, whatever that capillary bed is. But in this particular case, notice there are two capillary beds back to back. Here's capillary bed number one in the hypothalamus. Here's capillary bed number two in the pituitary gland. And this is a special circulatory system. You might know about three other places in the body where we have this kind of circulatory system. And what's it called? It's labeled. It's a portal system. So a portal system has two capillary beds back to back that are connected by a portal vessel. And in anatomy, I'm sure you heard of the hepatic portal blood vessel, which is between where? Two capillary beds, one in the digestive tract, and then the other in the, what's hepatic? Yeah, liver. Right, so that the toxic compounds that we absorb from our digestive tract aren't just dumped into our body directly. They have to go through the liver first, where your liver has the first shot at detoxifying them first. All right, probably we couldn't survive without that. So a portal system is a special delivery system. So the releasing factors are delivered directly to the anterior pituitary gland. All right, the second part is the posterior. This is neuronal tissue, and it's connected. The pituitary is connected to the hypothalamus by this structure right here, which we call the infundibulum, which contains the portal vessel plus tracts from the hypothalamus. And what did I call the infundibulum one time? Okay, it reminds me of a peduncle, right? Like the cerebral peduncle or a cerebellar peduncle. But this is what? Minuscule compared to those. So I call that like a peduncolito, right? A little peduncle. Okay, so the two nuclei in the hypothalamus are responsible for causing the release of two hormones from the posterior pituitary are the paraventricular and the supraoptic nucleus. And of course, a nucleus is what? Just a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system someplace. Then these have axons that go through the infundibulum to the posterior pituitary, and when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, that causes the release of two compounds, one called ADH and the other oxytocin. ADH is, what's the long form for ADH? Antidiuretic hormone. So what does a diuretic do? Yeah, it makes you pee. It decreases your water. An antidiuretic hormone does what? Makes you retain water, because it's the opposite of a diuretic. And oxytocin, on the other hand, is a smooth muscle stimulant, causes some smooth muscles to contract, especially during parturition, smooth muscle in the uterus, and also the milk letdown reflex during nursing. All right, so these right here are hormones because they're picked up by the circulatory system, but they're also neurotransmitters because they're released by neurons. I'm in my sleeve. I need a safety pin. Or maybe I could move over here. That works. I know, but I forget. Okay, so what's the best way to think of ADH and oxytocin? Are they neurotransmitters or hormones? Neurohormones. So here is still another example. When we look at the nervous system and endocrine system, you can't separate them in a number of locations in the body, so we should study them as what? The neuroendocrine system combined, because here is an interface between them. So this tract, and remember, a tract is what? Just white matter in the central nervous system someplace, a group of axons going someplace. This is the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. Hypothalamo means what? Hypothalamus. And hypophysis is another name for the pituitary gland. Okay, so that's it for ADH and oxytocin. Yeah. Absolutely. Really? I think there are. I'll double check. So maybe after class, so I'll be sure to look. Well, I'll mouse over there and click on it if we have time after class. Okay. So let's turn our attention from the posterior pituitary. We talked about the effects of ADH and oxytocin. Let me just say that there are times when there might be a pituitary tumor that is preventing the release of ADH. So if someone is not secreting ADH, antidiuretic hormone, what kind of position is their body in? What are they losing? They're losing a lot of water, because ADH makes you retain water. Without it, you'll be losing a lot of water. You'll be in a diuretic state, so you're going to be going to the bathroom all the time. And to prevent yourself from dying, if you're peeing all the time, what else do you have to do? You got to be drinking all the time, right? So it's relatively easy to diagnose, because you see somebody drinking water constantly, you know, in grade school. Plus, what else are they doing? They're raising their hand and say, "Could I go to the bathroom?" like every 15, 20 minutes, okay? So that could be a nice sign of some kind of pituitary tumor related to antidiuretic hormone. And what is that condition called? Because I think we talked about it on Thursday. So diabetes mellitus, because you lose glucose in the urine when it exceeds the renal threshold, that puts you into diuresis as well. You pee a lot when you have diabetes mellitus. So when you have abnormally low ADH, that's diabetes too. I mean, diabetes as well, but it's called diabetes insipidus, not diabetes mellitus. So now you know a couple different kinds of diabetes. Diabetes mellitus 1, diabetes mellitus type 2, and diabetes insipidus. Okay, so for these hormones from the anterior pituitary, right, they move as releasing factors from the hypothalamus through the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system instead of a tract. It's a portal system. And one releases prolactin, which goes to the breast, that causes development of glandular tissue of the breast. Didn't I go over this already?
No.
No? Okay. Okay. Growth hormone, or GH, causes growth of muscles, bones, and adipose tissue. There are gonadotropins, two gonadotropins, one called follicle-stimulating hormone, and the other is called luteinizing hormone. Follicle-stimulating hormone in the female causes the maturation of an immature follicle in the ovary to a mature state that's ready to ovulate an egg or an oocyte. LH works primarily from mid-cycle that causes a mature follicle to ovulate an egg. Alright, so those are both gonadotropins because they work on the gonads. So what are two examples of gonads? Those are gonadotropins, but what is a gonad? A gonad is an ovary or a testes. Okay? So a gonad is just a generic term for primary reproductive organ. Okay. ACTH, that stands for adrenal corticotropic hormone, that works on the adrenal cortex. So what is the adrenal cortex? Where I have the cursor right now? Or where I have the cursor right now? The first case or second case? That second one, because the cortex is what part of an organ? The more superficial part or the outside part, and the deep part is called the medulla. And the kidney certainly has a medulla and a cortex. Bones have medulla, cortex, right? Most organs have a deep part and a superficial part. And then thyroid stimulating hormone causes the thyroid gland to synthesize thyroid hormone or thyroxine and also release thyroxine from the thyroid gland. Okay, so here's just a list of what these hormones do, but I want to stay on this slide for just a second and talk about the hypothalamus. So let's see. Here is, and this is kind of a simplistic view. All right, but that, what gland is that? Thyroid gland, perfect. All right, so what does a thyroid gland secrete? Thyroxine, all right, maybe T3, T4. I don't know if we talked about that yet, but we will. All right, what causes the thyroid gland to release thyroxine? So, oh yeah, the pituitary gland. All right, so where's the pituitary? Here's the pituitary gland. All right, so here's the posterior pituitary. Here's the anterior pituitary. So, which part of the pituitary is going to stimulate the thyroid gland? Anterior pituitary, going to go to the thyroid. What do we call that hormone? Thyroid stimulating hormone. Okay. And what causes the anterior pituitary to release TSH? The hypothalamus. I don't know what the hypothalamus looks like, but it's up over here someplace, right? So here's the hypothalamus. Okay, so is there a neural connection or a hormone connection to the anterior pituitary? Remember, one is actually nervous tissue and the other is glandular tissue. Nervous tissue is the posterior pituitary, which releases what? ADH, oxytocin, because there are axons that come down. But the anterior pituitary has blood vessels. So there are hormones, actually neural hormones, coming from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary. So for TSH, what do we call, generally we said those were called releasing hormones or releasing factors. Okay, you're right, they're neural hormones, but more generally they're releasing factors or releasing hormones. So specifically, the ones that work on the glandular tissue for TSH are called TSH-what? RH, releasing hormones or releasing factors. So, you know, I could just as easily say TSH, what? RF. They're the same thing. Some textbooks use one or the other. Maybe somebody will agree one of these days what to use. I'm not really sure. Okay. All right, so what other target organ do we have? How about this one right here? What's this one here? Can you see? Oh, it's behind the computer. Oh, I didn't draw it quite right. I should draw it like this. That's a testes. Okay? All right, so what stimulates the testes? Where does it come from? You've got what? FSH, LH, going here and here. Both of these are called what? Gonadotropins. Sometimes we just abbreviate it GN, gonadotropins. FSH and LH are gonadotropins. Where do the gonadotropins come from? Posterior? No, they're going to the gonad. Are they coming from posterior or anterior pituitary? Remember, ADH and oxytocin from posterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary release gonadotropins. All right, so it goes like that. What causes the release of gonadotropins from the anterior pituitary? It's a hypothalamus. So there's something coming down from the hypothalamus. What the heck are these things? These are gonadotropin what? Releasing hormones. Or releasing factors. Okay. All right. Let's try one more. How about the hat? What's that? Adrenal cortex. What stimulates the adrenal cortex? Adrenal corticotropic hormone. All right, and that's going to stimulate the release of, well, aldosterone and cortisone, two general classes of hormones. This is a mineralocorticoid. This is a glucocorticoid. You're going to see this affects sodium. This affects what? Glucose in the body. So adrenal corticotropic hormone. Where does ACTH come from? Anterior pituitary. How does the anterior pituitary know when to release ACTH? Hypothalamus is going to release something. What is it going to release? ACTHRH. Okay, so you're getting a feel for how that works? I probably don't need to do it much more than that. Right?
We could do it all night.
RHs, RS, from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary to these target tissues right here. Okay, so you know what? It seems complicated the first time you look at it, but it's probably not too bad. Probably the difficult thing to remember is which is the posterior and which is the anterior pituitary and what hormones they secrete. But here's a pretty nice diagram that shows that. Don't forget, releasing factors. Get to the anterior pituitary via this hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. Which is what? Between the hypothalamus and the pituitary, that portal vessel. Okay.
That's going to lead into the pituitary?
Anterior pituitary in particular. Okay. So don't forget, release of anterior pituitary hormones is controlled by hypothalamic releasing hormones and sometimes inhibitory factors or inhibitory hormones. And it's regulated by feedback from levels of different target glands. Okay, so I think I talked about this already. All right, so here is the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system taking releasing hormones or releasing factors to the anterior pituitary. And then when the anterior pituitary releases those hormones, again, that's picked up by the blood, these cells right here are not nervous tissue whatsoever. So this is glandular tissue. So everything on that slide, this one right here, these are what? These are actual hormones, not neurohormones, like from the posterior pituitary gland. Okay. Sometimes, let me see if I can find this slide. Sometimes we call this the adenohypophysis. Where was that slide? Ah, yeah, here. Sometimes we call this the neurohypophysis. Hypophysis means pituitary, below the hypothalamus. And neuro because it's part brain, right? This is the adenohypophysis because what kind of tissue is it? It's glandular tissue. So anytime you see this adeno, that means what? Glandular tissue, like an adenocarcinoma, is some kind of cancer derived from glandular tissue, right, as opposed to bone or some other, or muscle or some other kind of tumor tissue.
And the other one is what kind of tissue?
Nervous tissue. It comes from the brain. Neurohypophysis. Neuro just means nervous tissue. Okay, so I'm not really too concerned that you know where the pars tuberalis is and pars distalis and stuff, but you should at least know that there's two parts to that pituitary and what hormones come from them. Okay, well, feedback control to maintain just the right level of hormones is under, or homeostatic control of hormone levels is controlled by what kind of feedback mechanism? Yeah, usually negative feedback, right? Okay. And there are long loops and short loops. So let's look at this particular loop right here. Here are the gonads, and these are going to be releasing sex hormones. So female going to be releasing estrogen, progesterone, male is going to be releasing testosterone. And what causes the release of those sex steroids from the reproductive organ is going to be, yeah, gonadotropins, right, FSH and LH, which come from the anterior pituitary. And the anterior pituitary will release gonadotropins when they receive, what, GnRH from the hypothalamus. All right, so there has to be set points in the anterior pituitary and the hypothalamus to know what the correct level of the sex steroids are. All right, so when a gonad releases, let's just pick one, estrogen. Estrogen's in the circulation, and where does it go? Where does estrogen go once it's released into the blood? Yeah, well, it goes everywhere in the body, and it's going to stimulate a target tissue or target cell when it has a receptor. There are cells that have receptors in the anterior pituitary, as well as the hypothalamus and other places too, but these are the two main regulatory centers. So there's a set point in the anterior pituitary and the hypothalamus. All right, so estrogen feeds back to the anterior pituitary, and it inhibits the release of FSH and LH. All right, so the response is what? Increased level of estrogen, that's going to feed back to the anterior pituitary, cutting back the levels of FSH and LH, and that decreases estrogen, so the stimulus and response subtract from each other, so that's a negative feedback mechanism maintaining the proper level of estrogen. So this is what we call a short feedback loop, right? From the target tissue, like the gonads, going back to the anterior pituitary. A long feedback loop takes estrogen all the way back to the hypothalamus. And levels of estrogen will inhibit the release of GnRH from the hypothalamus, bringing estrogen to the proper level because the response subtracts from the stimulus. And furthermore, sometimes these feedback cycles can switch to positive, from negative feedback to positive feedback. And in the case of ovulation, right, mid-cycle, in the ovulatory cycle in women, estrogen causes an increase in LH, which causes an increase in estrogen, which causes a bigger release of luteinizing hormone, right around day 14 of the ovulatory cycle, and that big peak in luteinizing hormone causes the expulsion of a mature egg from a mature follicle, or what we call ovulation. All right, but notice that that positive feedback is very short-lived because as soon as the egg is ovulated, then the positive feedback cycle is broken and a couple things can happen then to the reproductive cycle. Okay, it could start all over again if there is no pregnancy, or if pregnancy should happen, then other hormones take over to maintain pregnancy. All right, so don't forget about these two kinds of loops, short loop versus long loop. And
so the short one takes you back to the anterior.
Yeah.
And then the other one takes you back to
the hypothalamus. Exactly right. And since the hypothalamus is in the brain, other things that are happening inside the brain can affect these hormone cycles. Right? And that will affect the release of various hormones from the anterior pituitary. For instance, emotional states, psychological stresses can affect circadian rhythms because melatonin is a part of that. Menstrual cycle, for instance, because that relies on gonadotropins, And adrenal hormones like cortisol, right? So stress can increase things like weight and depression and things like that. All right, posterior pituitary. We talked about the two hormones, ADH and oxytocin. And this is also interesting. Oxytocin participates in a positive feedback mechanism during, well, actually during parturition and milk letdown reflex. Okay, so there aren't many positive feedback mechanisms. So what does a positive feedback mechanism do? For instance, let's consider milk letdown reflex. After parturition, the infant wants to start nursing, right? So an infant will start suckling on the breast. And the mother has nerves that go from the breast to the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus realizes what? Oh, there's somebody trying to nurse. So the hypothalamus then sends action potentials down for release of oxytocin. Oxytocin travels through the whole body, but there are oxytocin receptors in the breast, which then contract and eject milk from the breast. So what happens to the nursing infant? Does it get bored or does it get stimulated? It says, aha, time to eat, right? It's stimulated. So the infant suckles more, which sends what? More signals to the hypothalamus, which releases more oxytocin, which releases more milk, which stimulates the infant even more. So that's a positive feedback cycle. Now, how does that positive feedback cycle stop? How come the whole world isn't filled up with breast milk? How come we're just not swimming in breast milk? What happens that breaks that positive feedback cycle? Sometimes I think of things in a little bit different way. Well, for instance, the breast just runs out of milk. Okay, you can only nurse an infant so long, and you've reached the limits of milk production from that breast. And what happens to the interest of the infant when it suckles and it doesn't receive any nourishment? It gets bored. Okay, no longer any stimulation to the hypothalamus. All right, and the positive feedback cycle now is stopped, and then the breast gets back busy making more milk product, okay, for the next time. All right, so that's a nice positive feedback cycle. Oxytocin with parturition is positive feedback as well, because there are hormones released from the fetus. Parturition is controlled by the baby, not the mom. And as the baby gets bigger and bigger and bigger in the uterus, does it get more stressed or less stressed? More stressed. Why is that? It's got no room, yeah, to play soccer anymore in there or whatever it's doing. I'm not sure what it does in there, but it's running around, okay? And as the baby outgrows the uterus, it feels constrained. It releases stress hormones, which go to the maternal circulation, and the mother releases oxytocin. Oxytocin causes constriction of the uterus, which produces what? In the fetus. More stress hormones, more oxytocin, more stress, and then something's got to happen to break that. And that is what? Parturition. Right? So that positive feedback is stopped at that point. Okay, so the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus produces ADH, the paraventricular produces oxytocin, and both are transported by axoplasmic flow down the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, stored at the axon terminal, and they're stored there until an action potential reaches the axon terminus and then they are released. Okay, the adrenal gland. Well, I'll tell you what, before we get to the adrenal gland, anybody have any questions or comments about the pituitary? The pituitary sort of is considered like the major endocrine control gland in the body, because it's controlling what? The thyroid gland and bone growth and the gonads and various other endocrine glands in the body, including the adrenal cortex. All right, so here we see the adrenal gland on top of the kidney. Sometimes we call that the suprarenal gland. And it's got two parts, the medulla. What's the medulla most noted for? Because we studied that already. There are chromaffin cells inside the medulla responsible for releasing what? We looked at autonomic nervous system. That's a hint. It releases epinephrine. And a little bit of norepinephrine, which acts like what? A sympathetic neurotransmitter pretty much all over the body. But we're not so concerned with the medulla right now. We're interested in the adrenal cortex. Right, that's the most superficial part of the adrenal gland, and indeed, the adrenal cortex has different layers associated with it. Right, there is a capsule around the adrenal gland that's made up of connective tissue, and then the first layer is the zona glomerulosa. The next deepest layer of the cortex is the fasciculata, and then the next deepest layer is the reticularis, right here, and they're responsible for synthesizing and secreting different kinds of hormones, but they all respond to ACTH. All right, so we said the medulla is controlled by sympathetic innervation. The chromaffin cells act like what? The postganglionic cell. The cortex is controlled by ACTH. Two main kinds of hormones are cortisol, which inhibits glucose utilization and stimulates gluconeogenesis. What's gluconeogenesis? Gluconeogenesis? Yeah, making glucose from smaller precursors, like pyruvate, for instance. Okay? So it's making glucose, and it inhibits glucose utilization. Where does that glucose end up? Ends up in the blood. Okay, so it can elevate blood glucose levels, and if there's elevated glucose in the blood, adipocytes love to gobble it up and make more fat. Okay, that happens during stressful situations. So this is what we call a glucocorticoid. Corticoid because it comes from what part of the adrenal gland? Ah, here. The cortex. There's another one. We call it aldosterone. And it stimulates the kidneys to reabsorb sodium, so it makes you retain sodium, but it makes you excrete in the urine potassium. That process of your body getting rid of potassium through urine is what we call secretion. Right, so a lot of times you might see a question on sodium and potassium balance in the body. And what can you tell me about the effects of aldosterone on sodium and potassium? Does it have the same effect on both of those or different effects? So, for instance, does aldosterone cause the secretion of both sodium and potassium or the resorption of both sodium and potassium or opposite effects on sodium and potassium? It's the opposite effect. All right, so just kind of file that away in the back of your mind sometime, someplace. And that is aldosterone. If you see a multiple choice question, you're going to see, well, it causes this and this, but sodium one way, potassium another way. That's always going to be your correct answer if you ever have to, like, take a board exam or something. And it's going to be what? Sodium resorption or secretion? Sodium resorption, you're going to retain sodium, but you're going to excrete potassium. It's going to have the opposite effect. And that's sort of interesting because we have some diuretics that we like to use that shove both sodium and potassium out of our bodies, which can be dangerous under some circumstances because we can't lose potassium. Why can't we lose potassium all the time? What's it important for? Like for, yeah, membrane potentials, resting membrane potentials, action potentials, things like that. So when somebody's on a diuretic and you're losing both sodium and potassium, you have to monitor your potassium levels to make sure that you're not secreting potassium. With aldosterone, you don't have to worry about that because it works in opposite directions. Yeah.
Here it is.
Oh, okay.
But I was just going to ask why our body wants
true. So you got cortisol, a glucocorticoid, aldosterone, since it's dealing not with glucose but with some minerals, namely sodium and potassium, we call that a mineralocorticoid. And then the third kind of hormone are sex steroids, namely androgens. So the adrenal cortex secretes glucocorticoids, mineralocorticoids, and androgens. Right? And androgens, no matter what sex you are. Which is really a good thing. I don't know if I have a slide on that. I don't have a slide on that. But I suppose you could tell me why. Why is it good for women to have androgens, which is a male sex hormone? Aggressive behavior. When is it important for a female to exhibit aggressive behavior? Like when protecting their young all the time. Yeah, like protecting children, okay? And also sex drive. That's dependent on androgens. Okay. Okay, all right, so where do these hormones come from? Well, the zona glomerulosa, which is where? That's the most superficial part of the adrenal cortex. Starts with a precursor molecule and makes aldosterone, a mineralocorticoid. So what's a precursor for all of these steroid hormones? Cholesterol. So you got to have just the right level of cholesterol in your body, right? Can't be devoid of cholesterol because you can't make mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, or even sex steroids without it. So cholesterol is converted into pregnenolone, which then gets converted to progesterone. That's important in females. I don't think it has any effect on males, but we might learn something. I might learn something. Anybody know effect of progesterone in male physiology? No. Yeah, you do? No. You have to see a Google, huh? Oh, abnormal, maybe. Gynecomastia? Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Maybe. Okay. Yeah.
Well,
okay. Yeah, not you. I don't know. Progesterone, perhaps. I'll have to do a Google on progesterone and male physiology and see if anything pops up. But I don't think anything. All right. So progesterone then gets converted into deoxycorticosterone, which gets converted into corticosterone, which finally gets converted into aldosterone. So these are all what? Related compounds. All right, and then the zona glomerulosa can secrete aldosterone. So the fasciculata and the reticularis, again, start with cholesterol, then still going to pregnenolone. All right, and notice that corticosterone is just what? The first part of the pathway for aldosterone, but it stops one conversion process short. So this is what, a metabolic pathway or chemical pathway. It can also make cortisol by using other derivatives of pregnenolone and progesterone to deoxycortisol and then finally cortisol. All right, and then androgens come from these hydroxypregnenolone derivatives. Right, and finally is converted into androstenedione and other kinds of androgens that are male sex hormones. Okay, so the adrenal cortex is pretty busy building all of those things. All right, adrenal medulla. We're familiar with that because the chromaffin cells release epinephrine and norepinephrine. Primarily epinephrine, maybe 80% epinephrine, 10%, 10 or 15% norepinephrine. And it gets innervation from the preganglionic sympathetic fibers. So these chromaffin cells act like the postganglionic sympathetic fibers. They're responsible for the fight or flight response, which I think we did a little exhibit of that. Then we do a little guided meditation on the flight and fight or flight response one time. Which increases what? Respiratory rate, increases heart rate, cardiac output, causes general vasoconstriction, which increases venous return, which increases cardiac output, and we saw that it also increases glycogenolysis and lipolysis as well, increasing blood glucose levels. All right, so stress and the adrenal gland. Stress induces a nonspecific response called general adaptation syndrome, or GAS. And that causes ACTH and cortisol release. So higher brain centers, when they perceive some kind of stressful situation, send signals to the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus releases ACTHRH, right? So that's just kind of abbreviated in your book. CRH is the same thing as ACTHRH or ACTHRF. Goes to the anterior pituitary, causing increased ACTH. Which then goes to the adrenal cortex, which releases cortisol, which feeds back to the hypothalamus in a long loop or short loop to the anterior pituitary, bringing the proper levels of cortisol into your system. So chronic stress can induce high levels of cortisol that cause a number of deleterious effects in the body. Atrophy of the hippocampus. What the heck is the hippocampus? Where do you find the hippocampus? Abdominal cavity? Mediastinum? Pelvic cavity? Where? It's in your brain. Yeah, it's in your cranial cavity. It's a part of your central nervous system, part of your brain. And the hippocampus, is involved in memory. But even probably more importantly, in the hippocampus, there are stem cells and there are neurotrophic factors released from the hippocampus, which allows your brain to remodel itself, to grow and respond to new and stressful situations, right? That's basically what learning is about. How do you handle new kinds of stimuli? So unfortunately, high levels of stress really inhibit the hypothalamus. It sort of gets burned out so that you can't deal with stressful situations, and that inability to deal with new circumstances in your life and the inability of your brain to remodel itself and loss of memory, those are all components of clinical depression. Okay? And so atrophy of the hippocampus is related to clinical depression. So antidepressants reverse these effects. So the hippocampus is very important from that standpoint. Chronic stress also reduces sensitivity of tissues to insulin. It produces insulin resistance. So if a tissue becomes insulin resistant, what can you tell me about diabetes? Is it exacerbated or is it ameliorated? It's exacerbated, right? So stress exacerbates diabetes because it produces insulin resistance. Chronic stress also inhibits vagus nerve activity. I don't know if I want to relate that to anything in the class. That's sort of interesting. But just think of all parasympathetic innervation when it's inhibited. What's the effect of the vagus on the heart? Slows the heart down, decreases cardiac output. We'll get into this a little bit. So eventually, what all that negative or inhibition of the heart does is that it lowers blood pressure. Okay, so if we inhibit the heart, if we stop the heart, what happens to your blood pressure? It drops, right? All right, so if we stop parasympathetic innervation on the heart, where is it going to have a tendency to drift? Is it going to be a stimulatory effect or an inhibitory effect on the heart? But if we stop the vagus, remember the vagus inhibits the heart, and if we cut that out, which way is the heart going to drift? It's going to be more stimulated, which means your blood pressure is going to increase as a result of that. So chronic stress, right, may be related to this vagus nerve inhibition, produces what? Hypertension. That's one way of thinking of that. All right, chronic stress also suppresses growth hormone, thyroid hormone, and gonadotropins. I don't want to relate to that at all, but anyway. Okay, the thyroid gland. Let me see how many more slides I got. Okay. The thyroid gland. Okay, the thyroid gland is just inferior to the larynx. It kind of surrounds the trachea, and it's anterior. So here's the thyroid gland, and it secretes tetroiodothreonine and triiodothreonine, T3, T4, which regulate basal metabolic rate or the basal metabolism inside our cells and is needed for growth as well as development. We don't actually have to worry about development anymore in here. Growth, maybe. It consists of microscopic follicles. So a follicle is just a small microscopic spherical-shaped structure with something on the inside. Right, the outer layer is made up of the follicular cells that synthesize T4. The inferior part is filled with colloid, and that is just a suspension of stuff. So a colloid you could think of almost as a tincture. It's a mixture of things maybe that aren't even in solution, but there are some insoluble parts to it, and it's filled with proteins. And here I don't have something. Where did it go? Ah, okay. So here is a follicle. So here are the follicular cells, and here's the colloid that's inside of a follicle. And in order for the thyroid gland to make a competent thyroid hormone or thyroxin, it needs an element to do that. It needs a mineral. And it needs, iodide to do that. So iodide in the blood is actively transported into the colloid, where it's oxidized to iodine, I2, and attached to tyrosines, right, of what we call the thyroglobulin. So thyroid hormone is attached to proteins in the colloid, and those proteins are what we call thyroglobulin. TSH, thyroid-stimulating hormone, where does TSH come from again? From the anterior pituitary, stimulates the hydrolysis of T4 and T3 from the thyroid globulin and then secretion. Okay, but T3 and T4 aren't going to have any physiologic effect unless it has what? The iodine bound to it. Okay, so in the absence of dietary iodide, T3 and T4 can't be made, so their levels are really, really low. All right, so let's look at a feedback loop. All right, so if there are low levels of T3 and T4 coming from the thyroid gland, what might be a reason there's low levels of T3 and T4? Not enough iodine, because your body cannot make iodide. You have to have that in your diet. How do we get iodide in our diet in the United States? Because I never see, table salt. Unless you buy it at a health food store or you eat sea salt, sea salt has some iodine in it. It is fortified with iodine so that it protects our thyroid glands here. But for instance, if somebody doesn't have iodide in their diet, the thyroid gland can't secrete T3 and T4, so there are low levels of T3 and T4. That feeds back to the anterior pituitary, and the anterior pituitary says, hey, there's no thyroid hormone in the blood. Thyroid gland, you better get busy and make some. How does the anterior pituitary tell the thyroid gland to get busy and make thyroxin? It releases TSH. So TSH levels skyrocket. It goes to the thyroid gland. It causes hypertrophy. The thyroid gland is going to proliferate. That means the cells are going to undergo mitosis. Thyroid gland is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. But even though it's getting bigger, can it make any thyroid hormone? Not without iodide. It can't. So the anterior pituitary is still unhappy. It says what? Thyroid gland, get busy, make some. Releases more TSH. Thyroid gland can't make it, but it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So the thyroid gland just gets huge. It could be as big as two fists on somebody's neck, and it's really obvious if you see that when somebody's walking down the street. And that's what we call goiter. It's on the slide right there. So goiter is due to inadequate levels of iodide in somebody's diet. Okay, so this would be due to the absence of that short feedback loop.
So what is the
treatment?
Yes.
Yeah. Iodine. Pretty simple. I mean, it seems like really simple why anybody in the world would suffer from that condition. Okay, but there are countries that, you know, just don't have iodine available or salt and things like that. So that's how it develops. So we don't see it very much in the United States unless there's a recent immigrant from someplace in a part of the world that just has very low naturally occurring iodine.
So if they don't get it from salt?
Well, what's another dietary source? Seaweed, I think, is pretty good. Probably fish is pretty good. Shellfish is good. Okay. Yeah. I don't think it's much in beef and things like that, but maybe. Okay, so that condition. Also, hypothyroidism. People with inadequate T3, T4 levels are hypothyroid. They have low BMR. They have a tendency to gain weight because their metabolic rate is so low. They're cold, so they can't maintain their body heat, and lethargic. That produces a condition called myxedema. What is edema?
A swelling.
Yes, swelling due to buildup of fluids in different parts of the body. Myxedema, specifically from hypothyroidism, is evident especially in the face, hands, and feet. Okay, so puffy facial look, hands and feet. During fetal development, hypothyroidism can produce cretinism, which is a severe mental retardation because the nervous system doesn't have the proper stimulus to develop. Hyperthyroidism. Graves' disease is a condition of hyperthyroidism, autoimmune disease where antibodies act like thyroid-stimulating hormones. So a person's immune system stimulates the thyroid gland to grow and over-secrete, and that produces hyperthyroidism. This produces a condition we call exothalamus, and I think you have a picture in your book, exothalamus, and that means that somebody has bilaterally two very prominent eyes. So their eyes are placed very anteriorly in their face. It kind of looks like they're popping out of their face. We call that exophthalmos. That would be due to hyperthyroidism. What happens if somebody has just one prominent eye and the other in a normal position? What would that maybe be due to? Could that be hyperthyroidism? Okay, the answer is that if it's bilateral, okay, it's bilateral because you have what, like excessive levels of thyroid stimulating hormone, right? So that's going to affect both eyes the same. But if only one eye is being affected, that's usually due to maybe some kind of tumor in the eye, maybe a retinal tumor or a tumor on the optic nerve or something that's actually pushing the eye out if it's just unilateral. Okay, I don't think I'm going to go over this chart. You might need to look at this chart to answer some of the questions in the book. Okay, parathyroid glands. So parathyroid means within the thyroid, but on the sides a little bit, and they're going to be posterior, embedded in the thyroid gland. They secrete parathyroid hormone, and the parathyroid glands have sensors for calcium, blood calcium. All right, so parathyroid hormone is the most important hormone for control of blood calcium levels. So is blood calcium important to regulate in your body, do you think? What do you need calcium in your body for? Well, bones for sure, right, to support yourself. Yeah, teeth, you need calcium in teeth too, for sure. What else do you need calcium for? Yeah, release of neurotransmitters, which is what? Synaptic transmission. That's how nerve cells communicate with each other. So without the proper level of calcium, nerves can't even communicate with each other. Two other important things for calcium, which we haven't talked about yet, blood clotting function. Blood won't clot, which means with a little paper cut, you can bleed to death without the right level of calcium. And also muscle contraction needs calcium. All right, so if you can't contract skeletal muscle, you can't breathe. You won't live very long, so calcium is extremely important. So parathyroid hormone is one of two hormones. Release is stimulated by decreased blood calcium levels, which does what? It acts on bones to cause demineralization of bones, to put calcium in bones into the blood. It causes the kidneys to spare calcium. That means to retain calcium so you don't lose calcium in urine. And it helps intestine to absorb calcium from the gastrointestinal tract. All of those increase blood calcium levels. So the stimulus for the parathyroid glands would be what? Decreasing blood calcium. Decreasing blood calcium causes release of PTH, which acts on both the kidneys and bone. At the kidneys, it causes reabsorption of calcium from urine. That puts calcium back in the blood, so increase blood calcium, decrease urinary excretion of calcium. PTH on bone causes the breakdown of bone, which you might not necessarily want, but it's better to have calcium, proper levels of calcium in the blood. So when you break down bone, demineralize bone, that increases blood calcium. So the response is what? Increase blood calcium. What was the initial stimulus? Decreasing blood calcium. So do these add together or subtract from each other? Does the response subtract or add to the stimulus? It subtracts from, so this kind of feedback is called negative feedback, helping maintain the proper level of calcium in the blood. Okay. Islets of Langerhans. So I think we're going to have to start here next time. I tell you what, next time let's just meet up here. Okay, instead of in that lecture room down below, because it takes about 15 minutes for us to, by the time I hang a note on the door and all that kind of stuff. Let's meet here next time. And you might want to just review some of the material on the pancreas in your textbook. And that might be about the only other thing I'm going to talk about in terms of the endocrine system in this chapter. But yeah, make sure you read over the pancreas pretty thoroughly. What are two important hormones from the pancreas? Anybody know? Insulin is one, and glucagon is another. All right, they affect glucose concentration in the blood. Which one decreases blood glucose? Which one decreases blood glucose? Insulin, yeah, because it allows for cellular uptake, so it's got to decrease blood. So which one increases blood glucose? Glucagon. That's right. They come from two different kinds of cells within the pancreas. So why don't you look up before next time which kind of cell secretes insulin, which one glucagon. And guess what? From lab, I think you already know. You had it on a test already. A quiz, probably. Right. Okay, let's see where the figures are. I have to hook up to this computer. I'll turn that one on and take a look.